Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium.
Opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
I am your host for Race Treaty tonight. We'd like to thank Black Talk Radio for having us part of the Black Talk family. And for those of you who may be listening for the first time, we come on every Friday night between 9 and 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to continue what we had started about 3 or 4 weeks ago, in that the United Nations has declared 2015 to 2024 the International Decade of African People, the theme being recognition, justice, and development. And what we have is to highlight an event that happened on Friday, April 29th, at the United Nations headquarters in New York City. And the theme of that show or that program was Women of African Descent at the Intersection of Race and Gender. It was a United Nations event, but it was also coupled with the Black Women's Truth and Reconciliation Tribunal and Commission that took place over around a 4-day period, starting on the 28th and closing on that Sunday. So last week we had played for you some of the program at the United Nations with commentary in between sections, as we will also do tonight. Recognition, justice, and development, the theme for the decade, the International Decade for People of African Descent. And that's such a befitting mandate because it really gets to the heart of the matter. That is the full recognition of African people as humans, since we have been denied that identification for over 500 years. It was, in fact, the antithesis of that that gave Europeans the self-appointed right to enslave us, to work us, to oppress us for their grand indictment and for the benefits thereof. This world in which we live is pivotal upon that premise that we're not humans. And in that became the excuse and the reason for our subjugation, which was no more than their greed. So it starts with the recognition of African people as human beings, as well as the recognition of the crimes that was committed in that affirmation or with that projection. Then we go on to the second part, injustice. If there's a crime, there's a criminal. If there's a criminal, there's a victim. The victim is there. He or she has been hurt and harmed. And the only way that harm can be repaired is through reparations. The full embodiment of a healing process of reparations. Compensation, restitution, as well as rehabilitation. So the justice is the rightful claim for reparations, and also a monitoring system to make sure that doesn't happen again. And with those two principles of recognition and justice, therefore we can engage in all that has to be done for full development: mental, physical, spiritual, emotional, social, substantive development in all areas of human endeavors. So we're going to now play for you where we left off last week from the panelists on women of African descent at the intersection of race and gender. And after the section, 15 minutes, we'll come back and comment on some of the things that were said in that, with the possible introduction to the next section.
And we want to ask the listeners at this point to bear with me as I try to locate where we left off last week. And just give us just a moment. We'll get there. Shouldn't take much.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you.
An inclusive approach.
Back
joining us. Our next speaker is Miss Matsilo Motsai, who has come even further from South Africa. And Ms. Motsai is also a gender rights activist, a screenwriter, and an author. And we thank you for coming all the way from South Africa. And next to her, closer to home, is Ms. Nadine Nuffville, although as I understand, originally from Jamaica too, who is the Deputy Director for Grant Development and Management at the Office on Violence Against Women with the U.S. Department of Justice. Also a longtime leader in this struggle, and we thank you for coming. And last but not least on the podium is Ms. Tracy Robinson, Jamaica's in the house today, who is a former commissioner with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and is a senior lecturer at the Faculty of Law at the University of West Indies. We welcome you, Ms. Robinson. And finally, last but certainly not least, many of you will recognize her name, Alicia Garza, who is co-founder of Black Women's Blueprint. Huh? Black Lives Matter. Did you say you're twins? I've been saying Black Women's Blueprint. It just rolled off the tongue. Alicia, I'm so sorry. Yes, Alicia Garza is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. And I don't even know where Alicia came from today, because I know she's been traveling all over the world. Oakland, here we go. And is also longtime movement leader in the United States, and I'm sure around the world. So thank you for joining us. And then I do want to mention, you met her already, Malika Miller, who opened the event up for us and will be closing it. And will be joined in her closing by another sister, Monica Simpson from Sister Song. Thank you all for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we're so honored to be in the same space with you. And thank you to everybody who made the time to join us this morning, for all your work, for your enthusiasm. We appreciate you. Thank you. So, we now turn to our invited guests for what I know is going to be a scintillating, high-minded discussion this morning. And I want to start with Mr. Reed, who is a member of the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. And I thought you could open us up, Mr. Reed, by talking to us a little bit about the trends that you're seeing from the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent as it relates to the situation of women of African descent in general.
Thank you, Ijem. And it is indeed an honor to be here this morning. Now, across the globe, Africans and the African diaspora continue to suffer inequality and disadvantage because of the legacy of slavery and colonialism. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, in recognizing the International Decade, states, "People of African descent are among the poorest and most marginalized communities around the world. They may experience discrimination in their access to justice, and they face alarmingly high rates of police violence and racial profiling. The working group recognizes inequities, brutalities, and atrocities directed toward billions of women and girls every day due to discrimination based on intersecting sources of sex, gender, religion, political or other opinions, social status, or disability. There is a strong connection between poverty and race, and between race and class, and how these social and economic constructs intertwine to deepen inequality for women of African descent. Women and girls of African descent face a triple whammy, three separate but tightly connected factors that work together: racial discrimination as black people, gender discrimination as women, and further discrimination due to their economic status. For millions of women of African descent, the color of their skin will color their future. They are more likely to be born in poverty. They have fewer possibilities to have access to housing, education, access to health. They have the lowest paid jobs. They experience the highest rates of maternal mortality. They are more likely to be incarcerated. They suffer sexual violence, and they are vulnerable to be trafficked. They are also excluded from influencing policy that may shape their future. There is an inextricable link between the three pillars of the decade. It is only through recognition of the past that true justice is possible, and development is only attainable when justice is upheld. Further achieving Goal 5 of the Sustainable Development Goals and the principles of universality and inclusivity of the 2030 Development Agenda are only possible if concrete efforts are made to leave no one behind, with particular focus on women and girls of African descent. Now, in closing, the working group urges states to incorporate a gender perspective in all programs of action against racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. States, international organizations, NGOs, and the private sector should also consult and involve women of African descent through a participatory and inclusive approach in the processes and decisions relating to the elaboration and implementation of programs and plans aimed at their social development. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Reed. I appreciate those. I appreciate the sentiment that we must have full and meaningful participation in our destinies. So you've talked a little bit about the trends globally. I wanted to turn to Ms. Nuffield, to talk a little bit about the unique challenges that face women of African descent in the United States. In particular, you know, we've heard a lot about programs that the present administration has developed for boys of African descent. I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit about the programs that you've worked on for girls of African descent, and particularly at the Department of Justice.
Thank you, Ejim. I'd like to second the comment from Mr. Ahmed that I'm so honored to be here with everybody today. I think this is such important work, and I feel like a very small representative of the Department of Justice, so I hope that I can do us justice. When thinking about the work of our office and the Office on Violence Against Women, we are charged with providing federal leadership in the United States government on reducing violence against women, particularly domestic violence, sexual assault, dating violence, and stalking. I started to think about the part of our mission that says that we are also charged with improving the administration of justice. And what does the administration of justice mean? Mm. And it occurred to me and became this strong feeling that I needed to say that justice cannot be removed from the people who apply it, nor can it be removed from the people who create the laws. I believe that this is actually a founding perspective of our office and the activities that we take on. And in the last 7 years, we've really seen such a strong commitment from the current administration to supporting this belief that justice is in fact a reflection of our society. It is a reflection of what we believe as a society and what we believe as individuals. And if we don't challenge our justice system, which is in fact made up of individuals, of human beings, if we don't challenge those human beings to take on a new perspective, then justice will not be achieved for everybody. And by that perspective that we've been trying to put forward, that the department has been trying to put forward, is a perspective that says that if we are not taking into consideration the experiences of the most marginalized, of the people with the least access, the least ability to influence the laws, influence their enforcement, then we will not achieve justice equality for everybody. And that means that we have to change our perspective on model interventions. If they come from the perspective of the mainstream, they will not take into consideration our unique historical experiences as women of African descent. They will be... They will be continued to focus on the perspective of the mainstream, which is all good and well if you happen to fall in the mainstream. But if you fall outside, those responses will not support our resiliencies. They will not respond to the persistent barriers that present themselves as we attempt to achieve justice and equality. They will be focused on maintaining the status quo. So from within, we must continue to challenge ourselves to create a different perspective. And so that is the activity that we've been taking on most recently, is how do we challenge ourselves from within? How do we create different grant programs? How do we look at evidence-based practices differently? So to that end, we've been working with organizations like the Black Women's Blueprint to develop a new model designed around the campus violence response that will support the historically black college perspective. Because there is a very different perspective for black college students, whether they are attending HBCUs or large mainstream universities. So I'm going to close on that to say that thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Ms. Nuffield. I appreciate those comments. In particular, the idea that policies must be informed by the people who are most directly impacted. So we appreciate that the Department of Justice has taken this approach. Our next speaker is Ms. Matsai, who, as I mentioned earlier, is a gender activist from South Africa. And you've done a lot of work across the African continent, working with women. One thing that marked me is that you've also focused on working with men as part of the solution. So I thought that maybe you could share with us the reasons why you think it's important to focus on men as part of the solution. And what are some of the unique aspects of advancing justice as healing from an indigenous African perspective?
Let me follow on the previous speakers and thank everyone for being here. But most particularly, I want to thank Farah, who I met in Cape Town in February. We were in a circle of healing, and we bonded. And here I am in the room with all of you. I want to flip the coin a bit. I'd like to flip a coin a bit in my response to you, that when you hear the word Africa, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? I think the first thing that comes to our mind is dispossession, poverty, powerlessness, corruption, and so on. And I feel like there's a need for a change of narrative. Absolutely. As a writer, you know, when you write, the character is the one that leads you. But we continue to write the same story, the same narrative, and we force the character to remain powerless. Yes. So in a sense, as a result, then even when things change, even when the character changes, we don't see it. We come up with the same policies, the same regulations, because we are looking at the same outcome. So in the way that we work, I'd like us to begin to think about changing the narrative. African women don't need to be rescued. African women have their own definition of power. When you see her walk in, you might see a poor person. You might see a powerless person. But they carry power differently. They express their power differently. And therefore, there must be something about them that we need to learn from them. Because if it wasn't for that, they wouldn't be standing now. The reason why I'm working with men to answer the second question, two reasons, personal and political. Personal, I was raised by the most beautiful black man who was always there for me, who was also raised by the most beautiful black man. So for me, the narrative of a bad black man does not apply. So I saw it fit to step out and work with black men. And as a result, the work chooses me. Incidentally, Sunday before I came here, I got a note from one of the maximum prisons in Pretoria, a young man who has been incarcerated for gang rape. He asked me to come and see him. And I went there, and this is part of the work that I do. Because whether they are in or out, they are a part of us. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Matsai.
No, I'm not a writer.
Okay.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
This is Onaji Mawid, host of Race Treaty on Black Talk Radio. And those of you who may just be tuning in, we're listening to the panelists on a program at the United Nations on April the 29th. And we've heard remarks from Ahmed Reed, member of the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent from Jamaica, Nadine Nevel, from Deputy Director for Grant Development and Management, Office on Violence Against Women, U.S. Department of Justice, as well as Emma Sikilo, Timilo Matse, poet, writer, and gender activist from South Africa. And you heard in their remarks, for those who were listening, very important points that is justice is not blind. It doesn't happen with equal distribution. It comes out of the minds and the values of the people who have written the laws and who administrate the laws. If we don't take that into consideration, we're deceiving ourselves. So therefore, to go further, we are saying it's imperative that they come to an understanding of what racism is. The People's Institute for Survival and Beyond has a 2.5-day workshop called Undoing Racism. And they've been doing this for 30 years, almost an impossible thing to consider that they have been around that long teaching on the subject of institutional racism. But one of the speakers mentioned something we have to do inside, which is how then do we participate in the process of undoing racism inside of us? The Theater of Oppress out of New York City says the cop in our head. That's how they defined it. Internalized oppression, internalized racial inferiority, and for those who have the legacy of controlling these institutions, internalized superiority. Racism by the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond says it is both, and this is very key here, both racial prejudice plus power, legitimate power, power to control institutions. So we are very confused on what the definition of racism is, and in that confusion we get no place because what we have is something that is a false definition. Prejudice, bias, discrimination, people kind of put them all together, stereotypes. No, all of them are different, and the key element in that, in all of them, is the question of power, and the power is graduated to the extent that it becomes institutionalized, to the extent that it becomes historical. So for one of the panelists to talk about the internal work, it is everybody's job to do undue racism inside oneself, inside one's family, inside one's community, so forth and so on. So we're going to continue now with the panel speaking on the intersection of African women, the intersection of African women with race and gender.
I was quiet. I was waiting for you to keep going. But no, thank you for those really insightful, thought-provoking comments. I'd now like to turn to the continent of Europe. I'd like to ask Ms. Bonnie Claverie to tell us about the challenges faced by women of African descent in embracing their African identity in France in particular. And tell us how that identity is received by the state. And if you could also share with us some of the policies and discourse around this issue of assimilation or colorblind societies, if you will.
First, I'm very grateful to be here with you today. I want to thank in particular Kali Onyinba, sorry, for inviting me. First of all, I think it's important to have in mind that France is a country in Europe where you have the most important black population. It's between 6% and 8% of the population. By comparison, in Great Britain, you only have 3% of black people. So, but we're very behind. Because when, for instance, I say between 6% and 8%, it's because in France, ethnic statistics are forbidden. So you're not, yeah. So yes, because France is officially a colorblind country. We don't acknowledge race. And believes in republic universalism, in which everybody should merge. But of course, when you think about this universalism, what it is made of, it's based on French white culture. Because for centuries, being French meant being white. So it's very difficult when you're a woman of African descent to just to have the space to exist, to fully exist, because first of all, you won't be totally considered as French, because you will still belong to the colonial space and seen as a foreigner who then must assimilate or make special efforts to prove his her Frenchness. And then if you claim your African or Caribbean heritage, then you will be suspected of communitarism. And communitarism is not something valued like here in the United States. In France, communitarism means a breach of the universalism motto, so then it means a menace to the unity of the society. So it's violently and strongly condemned, both by the state and the medias. So it's quite difficult to have the space to exist politically, socially, culturally as a black person in France. And I guess as a consequence of this, in 2005, we had our own Watts riots led by young, black, and in less proportion, Arabic men from the inner cities. And that's the year when the black question emerged in France. And for the first time, the state acknowledged that they had a black minority and they had to do something to include us in the country. But still, 10 years later, nothing has changed, really. But one of the consequences of this riot is the birth of a new generation of activists. And interestingly enough, most of these activists, or the most prominent ones, are women. And I think, I haven't read a study about that, but I think it's because black women in France are far more educated than black men, especially black women of West African or Caribbean descent. But still, this movement is very embryonic, and it is violently contested, both by the traditional anti-racism organizations and the states. To give you an example, last December, black and Arabic women organizations organized a march for dignity to protest against police brutality and the killing of black or Arabic men. And the state delegate in charge of anti-racism publicly condemned this march, saying it was against the Republic, it was anti-democratic, it was communitarist and anti-Semite. And he called the organizers perverted anti-racist. And one of the reasons, I think, to end of this verbal violence is, I think, new activists don't belong to the establishment. They are African or Arabic descent. They are pro-Ville, which is seen as a pro-Islamic position. And they claim that universalism is a disguised way to maintain the white privilege. So I think that in France, we are very much isolated, and we'll finish on this. And I think we need bonds, we need recognition from the outside. And as we look to the United States as a model of, in search of role models, because we don't have them in France, well, I will call for, yes, more bonds between the two countries.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Bonnie Claveri. And, you know, I think part of one of the reasons or hopes for this event is that we build that cross-national bonds and build our collective voice and power. And I will say that I would ask you to speak to a number of the activists in the room afterwards from the U.S., because a lot of what you're facing in France, people actually face here, too, in terms of embracing a black identity being seen as a menace to society. And the latest example of that was Beyoncé's very benign video called Information. So, you know, we're here today, and we've talked about this earlier, that we are talking about women of African descent and embracing our full identities, our full diversity. And so we're delighted to now turn to Ms. Janet Mock. And I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit about the unique needs of transgender women of African descent, and that if you had one recommendation for recognizing the full identity and addressing the needs of transgender women of African descent, if you could share that with us.
So I'm so honored to be here, and I'm really thankful to Black Women's Blueprint for in being sure that they were inclusive in their definitions of what is a woman, right? We go back to Sojourner Truth, who said, "Ain't I a woman," right? And so knowing that tradition, often in these spaces where we center girls and women, we don't include my trans sisters and myself. And when folks say that they're fighting on behalf or advocating for the protection of girls and women, they're usually speaking about a very specific girl, right? She's usually not trans. She's usually perceived to be straight. She is usually the epitome of respectability. She hasn't engaged in sex work. She is white and or close to whiteness as possible. And we create and recreate these hierarchies within our own communities as well, right? The right kind of victim, the one that we will rally behind and fight for and advocate on behalf of. And it's rare that they're talking about Black trans women and girls who are the center of my work and my writing and my existence, and who I know to be not only the most vulnerable and invisibilized populations, but as my co-panelist here from South Africa said, my sister, she said that we are also some of the most resilient and resourceful people as well. But recognizing that resourcefulness and resilience, we have to also be cognizant of the fact that these women and girls are grappling with homelessness and joblessness and a lack of access to healthcare and education. And these issues push them out of hostile homes and intolerant schools and into detention homes and facilities and prisons and deeper into poverty. And these interconnected issues also push them into underground economies like the drug trade and sex work and sex trade, which is often the default method unto which Black trans women earn the money to nurture themselves in societies that do not want them to exist, in societies that do not offer them food and medicine and clothing and shelter. And this dangerous and stigmatized work makes them even more vulnerable to HIV. And trans women of color, Black trans women specifically, are among the most at-risk demographic as well as the most likely to face medical discrimination when it comes to HIV. And trans women of color are more likely to be profiled, incarcerated, and targets of abuse and violence. And these alarming issues often go uncharted and remain widely unaddressed because we, as a society, collectively do not acknowledge that trans women are women or even people, that Black bodies matter, and that trans girls and women of color are worthy of our protection and care. These girls that I know and I love, and many of which I will never be able to meet because they do not exist anymore, are at the intersection. They exist and stand at the intersection of race, gender, and class on the margins of our society. And because women are not valued, because trans people are invalidated, because people of color, Black people specifically, are exiled, trans Black women live at the intersection of what I like to call pass her by and pay her no mind. These girls and countless women and others have been beaten and jailed, extinguished and exiled because they are girls and women, because they are Black girls and women, because they are Black girls and women who are trans. And in the world that I see that these girls are protected and nurtured and liberated, and they no longer fall in between the gaps of our coalitions, right? And these coalitions include the feminist movement, the Black racial justice movement, and LGBT movements. They are centered, and they are centered because they matter, and they are centered because our own liberation lies in their well-being and care.
Thank you, Ms. Mock. And I know you could have gone on.
I got 3 minutes.
Yes. 3 minutes. So I appreciate it. I appreciate it. And I appreciate the comment about the need for health care. If I understand it, in the United States, there are at least 34 states where you can still fire someone for being transgender from the job with no repercussion. It's legal. So talking about employment, talking about healthcare, talking about education, you know, that gets us to talk about a development agenda. And so, Ms. Robinson, I wanted to turn to you.
No, I'm not a writer.
Okay.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
This is Onajima Weed, host of Race Treaty. We are listening to the panelists who are addressing the theme, Women of African Descent at the Intersection of Race and Gender, which is held on April the 29th at the United Nations headquarters in New York, New York. And the last speaker was speaking about black transgendered women and the struggles they go through, through discrimination, rape, beatings, imprisonment, denial of basic human rights and medical services. Very important subject that we have to pay attention to. And you can see from the breadth of the panelists, they're covering a wide range of women issues, which are not just women's issues. These are human issues, and certainly they are the black community's issues. So we should never feel that the victims of someone else's oppression and terrorism is the only person or group responsible for its correction. These are corrections that have to happen from the context of humanity. That's why we say human rights. So pay close attention. And for those of you who'd want to listen to the whole entire panel discussion, you can find it on WebTV, webtv.un.org. And if you put in after that African, Women of African Descent, Intersection of Race and Gender, that'll probably pop up for you. So we're glad to rebroadcast the live event that happened on April 29th, but we also want to give you access to it and encourage you to show it to your family, show it to your friends. It's saying that women and black girls are the centrality of a decade of International Decade of African People, and this panel discussion has set it off rightly so. So now we're going to return to the panelists, see how much of it we can get in before we close out. So this will be the last section of this panel discussion for tonight. This is Onajima Weed, host of Race Treaty on Black Talk Radio.
And to say, you know, we've talked about the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, as people often hear, and their pledge to leave no one behind, including women and girls, cis and trans. So, drawing from your tenure on the Inter-American Commission, which represents the whole region of Latin America and the Caribbean, and including the work you've done with LGBTI women of African descent, could you talk a little bit about what the situation is and what that development agenda would look like if it met the needs of women of African descent?
Thank you very much, Ajim. Like everybody else, it's a privilege to be here. And I'd begin by saying that it's absolutely essential that the overlap of the decade of people of African descent and the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development Goals count for something and be a productive intersection. The 2030 agenda can only transform the world if it transforms the lives of black women and girls in respect of all 17 goals and the over 150 specific targets. Though it is a universal agenda, an agenda according to the General Assembly for people, planet, and prosperity, and to strengthen universal peace and eradicate poverty, the principle of leaving no one behind means that no goal or target can be achieved if they have not been achieved for women and girls of African descent.
Thank you.
Notwithstanding the diversity of our lives in the Americas, and we're an exceptionally diverse region, regrettably, women of African descent are amongst the poorest in the countries they live in, and live in some of the poorest countries in the Americas as well. Women of African descent are struggling to control natural resources, which they have been historically connected to. They find that their lands and their bodies are at the front lines of contests about what development means, often around specific development projects. They're far more likely to die in childbirth than other women. They disproportionately assume responsibility for both paid and unpaid care work throughout the Americas. The SDGs use money targets, in some instances, for example, eradicating extreme poverty, measured as persons living on $1.25 a day. And although those are useful, essentially those won't capture the complexity of the lived experiences of black women in the Americas who face multiple and overlapping human rights violations. The question is, and I know this is the goal, how do the SDGs in reality become fully integrated and indivisible when the lives of black women are often not cognizable or even perceived? And I think in particular, very hauntedly, of a conversation with an Afro-Colombian lesbian I spoke to when as a member of the Inter-American Commission. She had been displaced multiple times during the conflict, all deeply related to her race, her gender, her sexuality, with no access to justice or sexual and reproductive health services. She bore 5 children, all of whom were the result of horrific rapes. Further entrenching her inequality, her marginality, her poverty. She was simply not cognizable to the persons I met in policy or elsewhere. There's an urgent need for SDGs to have an inclusive agenda. It is not about adding black women and stirring, as we often say. It is about being respected, being heard, being at the table. And finally, I want to say that one of the most stark calls for being heard relates to reparations. Yes. And simply to end by saying that our desire to move forward for progress can't move ahead unless we look at the past, unless we enjoy the right to the truth, unless there's accountability for what has happened to all of us.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson. And that segues into my next question. We've had a full discussion today about recognition, justice, development for women of African descent. So, Ms. Garza, Ms. Robinson just talked about reparations. So I'd like to ask you, what compensatory action do you think we need to advance recognition, justice, and development for black women, for women of African descent? What do we need to recognize? We've talked about the historical experience of women of African descent as it relates to slavery, segregation, colonialism. What does justice look like in that context? And how would this advance a true development agenda?
Thank you. Well, I want to start off my comments by just acknowledging two things. One, just thank you, Black Women's Blueprint, again, for bringing us together here. I think to answer this question, we have to acknowledge that there isn't any justice without truth. And that truth requires a fundamental acknowledgement, not just of the problems that exist, but more importantly, of the harms that have been caused and the impacts of those harms. that's why it's not enough for us to be just talking about the wage gap or our rising incarceration rates or the tens of thousands of us who have been disappeared, the too many of us who have been murdered, or the wars that are waged on and over our bodies. We have to talk about the impacts, the separation of families, the generational trauma, the impacts of capitalism and patriarchy and imperialism and racism on black women and black gender nonconforming people. And that means fundamentally that we are being denied, systematically denied, our fundamental human rights. So, recognition of the impacts of being denied our fundamental human rights have to come in the form of reparations.
Absolutely.
During the international decade for people of African descent, a full and robust discussion, plan of action, and implementation of that plan with ongoing evaluation is necessary. And without it, having this decade named for us borders on being merely symbolic. Thank you again to Black Women's Blueprint for demanding that this decade not be symbolic and for demanding that we break the silence around the violence that is being waged on our bodies. Now, in order to get to reparations, we must demand action that is financial and non-financial. Reparations that would advance a true development agenda would provide resources and support that is needed to transform these ongoing cycles of oppression and domination of black women and gender nonconforming people. We must demand parity amongst the many genders that exist in our communities. None of us are free until all of us are free. So parity that addresses the impacts of disproportionate discrimination and exclusion and the stripping of power and self-determination from black transgender women, from black cisgender women, and from black gender nonconforming people. Mm-hmm. Reparations in the form of a permanent Truth and Reconciliation Committee.
I like that.
So that we can document the many experiences of our people throughout the diaspora who have been robbed of our human rights and dignity for more than 400 years. Mm-hmm. We must demand financial compensation for black women and gender nonconforming folks and our families who are survivors of violence at the hands of the state, including but not limited to law enforcement.
Yes.
We must demand compensation in the form of services, healthcare, housing, education for black women and gender nonconforming people who have been impacted not just by state-sponsored violence, but by state-sanctioned violence. And finally, we must demand a re-education, a transformation of the ways in which we relate to one another.
Nice.
So that means transforming our laws, our education systems, our economy, and we must fundamentally demand a new and transformative democracy.
Yes.
In closing, I think one step that we also have to acknowledge to get us to true development is to ensure that we don't have to keep fighting to have our issues be recognized in the forums that are designated to ensure human rights for all of us. We have to demand transformation over comfort or protocol and be courageous enough to eradicate any protocol or practice that doesn't get us closer to our freedom.
Thank you.
This is Onajin Weed. You've been listening to Race Treaty through the capable hands of Brother Scott, Scotty Reed, and stay tuned. Come back next Friday between 9 and 10. Have a good night, everyone.